Good evening, everybody, and welcome to what is webinar 17 in the webinar series between Emerging Minds and MHPN. And tonight we're going to be able to discuss with you some practice skills about working with children who have experienced trauma. So welcome, my name's Dan Moss and really, really looking forward to joining with you tonight. And welcome to the about 1,000 of you who have already joined us for tonight's webinar and for those who are watching this through webcast. Welcome. So before we begin tonight, Emerging Minds and MHPN would just like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay respect to the elders past, present and future for the memories, the traditions, the culture and hopes of Indigenous Australia. So welcome to Series 3, and for those of you who have joined us previously, you'll know that we provide a series of webinars which are all focusing on the mental health of children and infants. So this is the third of our webinars in this series for this financial year, and we've got some coming up for you, which will be working with parents who have had their children removed, overcoming communication strategies to engage children, and a webinar later in the financial year regarding working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. So if you want to know more about these webinars, please subscribe to our web line on www.emergingminds.com.au/subscribe. So how to use the platform tonight, just a bit of housekeeping on that. To access the interactive features and resources, hover over any of these colourful icons to the top right of your screen. So the purple icon is to open the chat box, and we've got Joss in our chat room tonight who is facilitating a conversation. Blue is for you to ask the panel a question, and after our panel discussions tonight, we'll be having a Q&A session with our three panelists in which we'll be asking them the questions that you send through to us. Blue to access resources, including the case study, panel biographies and supporting resources for tonight. Yellow to open the survey, which we'll talk to you about later this evening. And green to reload the Page webinar room. So learning outcomes tonight. At the webinar's completion, participants will be able to describe how to work with children who have experienced trauma in ways that help them to feel more comfortable and confident. We want you to be able to illustrate some of the challenges in working with children who have experienced trauma and how these can be overcome. We want you to outline the questions and skills needed to help children explore the effects of trauma. And we want you to be able to explore skills required when a child might be reluctant to come and see you, might be feeling quite anxious or ambivalent about their engagement with you. So I'm now going to introduce tonight's panel, which is a great panel, and I'm really looking forward to hearing all three of their presentations tonight. But first I'm going to introduce Dr. Jackie Amos, who's a psychiatrist here in South Australia. Jackie is a psychiatrist who's worked for many years with children who have experienced trauma. What do you consider to be the most important practice skills in this work?
Dan, I've been thinking about that, and I think the most important skill is actually being able to establish a human-to-human connection where you and the child are just two human beings on a journey together trying to make sense of their world. And if you can do that, then I think a lot of other things follow.
Thanks so much, Jackie. Welcome, Chris Dolman, who's a social worker in South Australia and a member of the Emerging Minds content team. Chris, you've had many years' experience in working with children who have experienced trauma. But what are the principles that have grounded you in the work that you've done with these children? Chris, I think you might just be on mute there.
Sorry, Dan. Yeah, thanks. And hi, everyone. I think the principle that's most grounded me, as you say, or supported me in my work, is this notion that no child is a passive recipient of trauma. You know, children are always responding to the circumstances and events of their life, including the trauma that they're subjected to. They're always finding ways, and have found ways, to limit the impact of trauma on their life in some way, maybe even only small ways, or limiting the effects of the trauma in their life, in the ongoing effects. But children are always active in responding to the trauma. And I find this such a helpful and hopeful and generative principle in my work. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Thanks so much, Chris. And lastly, Kate Headley, who's a speech pathologist in the Trauma Service in New South Wales. Kate, so lovely to have you join us tonight. And as a speech pathologist, I know that much of your work focuses on the effects of children's communication where they've experienced trauma. So why is this an important thing for all practitioners to be focusing on?
Hi, Dan. Hi, everybody. Yeah, look, I do think it is really important for all professionals working with children, regardless of your discipline of profession, to understand and recognise that complex trauma impacts the communication skills of all children who've had those experiences, and it will impact it in varying ways. And I think as professionals, if we develop our skills in how to support communication, we can really help young people in their engagement in really helpful interventions.
Thanks so much, Kate. Really looking forward to hearing your presentation a little bit later on. So I'm going to now pass over to our panellists. And as you know, we're going to be thinking tonight a little bit about our case study, which is Jenny, who's 11 years old. Jenny's been through a few different foster placements ever since being removed from her biological parents when she was young. Jenny's got a few things going for her at the moment, including some issues at school, and she's going to come in to see whoever that might be, a psychiatrist, social worker, speech pathologist, feeling a little bit ambivalent or a little bit anxious about that engagement. And so tonight we're going to hear a little bit about the skills that our practitioners are going to use to be able to work with Jenny and, of course, other children who have experienced trauma. So first of all, I'm going to hand over to Jackie.
Thanks, Dan. When I was thinking about Jenny, I tried to imagine myself meeting her and meeting her situation. And what I realised was that there would be a lot of work that I would want to do before I met with Jenny. So that's how I'm going to focus tonight. So before the first meeting, I would usually consider holding a case conference with Jenny's social worker and probably her current foster parents too. Partly the social worker holds a sort of long longitudinal view of Jenny, so she's going to be able to provide that kind of bigger picture for Jenny's life. And the current foster parents have obviously got their current concerns. And I think it might help us to develop a shared understanding about what the people around Jenny think might be troubling Jenny, and help us do a bit of planning about what the purpose of a therapeutic intervention with Jenny might be, whether there might need to be some intervention with Jenny and the foster family, so who needs to be part of the process. And also, there's a really big question for me in this case scenario about Jenny's relationship with her mother. She's recently run to her mother, and her mother has been in the background but in her life for the whole of her life. So I also want to know what possibilities might exist for her relationship with her mother from the perspective of her guardian, who is obviously represented by the social worker. So that would probably be my starting place. Because that starting place is a kind of starting place of working with the system, I thought it would be useful to just say a little bit about how I think about my position in any kind of complex system. So I think the most important thing, if you're going to interact with the whole system, is to think about maintaining a really open mind regarding Jenny's mother, Jenny's desire of a connection with her mother, the foster family, and her child protection social worker. And it's really important not to prematurely accept anyone's version of reality as the truth, but to understand that everybody is offering a partial perspective. And by talking to a lot of people around Jenny, I'm hoping to get the richest picture and the richest description of her life that I can. I think that's particularly important here where it's we're already aware that the foster family perhaps have some reservations about Jenny's desire for a connection with her birth mother. As Dan said, I think Jenny is unlikely to be particularly open to therapy because her trust in adults and systems of care and concern will be pretty low. She's probably feeling quite let down. Entering into any new relationship will be fraught because she's discovered on a number of occasions that the place that she has in a family is tenuous and can change. And she may well have a belief about herself as not being important, having no place and not belonging. So entering into a relationship with a therapist, these will be questions that she carries into the room, I imagine. I also want to be really clear with Jenny at the start what the outcome of any kind of case conference has been about, what the purpose of therapy might be, how I imagine I might be of assistance to Jenny, and how long I'm likely to be a part of her life. Because if she's not sure about that, I think that in this situation she's going to be very wary. And I think the most important thing is that I don't want to make any false promises to Jenny. So none of those kind of statements that sometimes we want to make around, I'll always be here for you, because actually the truth is we probably won't. And she needs to really understand that she won't be let down. I think also because I tend to work with systems before I meet the young person, I would want to share openly with that young person what I already know about them, let them know who I've met with prior to the meeting, what information I've obtained from someone who's referred or what's come out of the meeting. And by letting her know the content in a way that is obviously appropriate to her, I'm going to give her an immediate right of reply to any of that information, which makes a space for her voice up front and makes a space for her viewpoint and indicates that her viewpoint is something that I'm interested in hearing. And I use this strategy because sometimes for children, it's easier to respond to information than to produce information. So it's giving her something to respond to. And just finally, because others are going to talk in more detail about this, I kind of keep a particular stance when I'm working with children of noticing, naming and waiting. So I avoid asking direct questions. I prefer to just offer statements to children about what I'm noticing about them and what they're doing and what I'm thinking about as I'm sitting with them. And then that allows the child or young person to respond to me or not kind of as they wish, which increases their power in the situation, I hope. And then I invite them to interact with anything that I have in the room or anything that they may have brought with them. So that we essentially are trying to create a pretty relaxed atmosphere out of what is a pretty tense situation. And I just also wanted to note, because this is sometimes something that happens, is that young people come in and they've got their phone and video game type things with them. And I will often spend quite a bit of time interacting with them around that or even via that. I would perhaps send text messages backwards and forwards for a while, rather than banishing anything like that from the room, so that, you know, we give that opportunity for the child to bring what's important to them as I bring what's important to me. So I think that's all from me for now, Dan. I'll hand back to you.
Thanks so much, Jackie. That was fantastic. And look forward to having you answer some questions in our Q&A later. So I'll now pass over to Chris Dolman to talk about a social worker's perspective.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Jackie. Yeah, really appreciate the way you spoke about how you position yourself and work with Jenny and the family, so thanks for that. I thought I'd just begin by speaking about some of the challenges that perhaps occurred to me as I read the case study with Jenny. I'll just really name them rather than go into a lot of detail. But what stood out to me was, of course, and Jackie touched on this, was Jenny's reluctance to participate, if for no other reason, perhaps on account of the effects of the trauma on her. The other challenge, I think, is in creating a safe context for her, for Jenny, who perhaps safety and trust has not always been respected or available to her. And this sense of challenge around establishing collaboration with her, a sense of partnership around what it is we're actually doing together would be significant. And tied with that, I guess, is really another challenge is, I guess, establishing, ensuring that our conversations are purposeful and that she has an interest in why we're meeting together. So I'm going to sort of speak about some ideas around responding to those challenges and some different options. And there's four of those, which I'll go through now, as well as speak a bit about accountability at the end there. So a key area that I'm always listening out for and wanting to get onto in working with children who've been subjected to trauma or experienced trauma is getting onto other aspects of their life that haven't been overtaken by the effects of the trauma. So listening out for, asking about, noticing what it is that interests them, their interests, what it is that they're good at, what it is that Jenny would enjoy. There's not a lot of information about that in the case study that's being provided, which perhaps we shouldn't be surprised about, but we can make it our business to find this out, to kind of research this with Jenny or with perhaps other people that love and care for her and are concerned about her as well, and use those as entry points into these conversations. The purpose really being to bring forward Jenny's skills and know-how that she uses in everyday life to kind of get through life and do things that she enjoys. And I find that actually somehow finding ways to document this, to record this, can be a great acknowledgement of these things, but can also, you know, these skills and know-how, these things can become usable, you know, as we continue to work together, usable in terms of perhaps how she might be responding to other circumstances or the problems that she's facing. And find ways to bring these into storylines, to trace the performance of these skills and know-how in her life over time with her. As she speaks about these things, she's also making claims about her identity that perhaps is separate from how she's being positioned or portrayed, or how she might have come to think about herself on account of what she's been through as well. So that's one key area. Another area for me, which I just find so important, is to come to understand what sense she'd be making of us meeting together. You know, what meaning does she make of this? And I do find one helpful way of that, not always, but a common way, can be to be tracing her understanding of how our conversations came about, you know, what she has been told about us meeting together, tracing the history of the conversation, if you like, how we got to this point. And, you know, invariably this is on account of the concerns of others. So to sort of finding ways to be hearing from her about what her guesses about what others might be concerned about. But importantly, for me, her response to these concerns, you know, does she side with them? Does she agree with them, or does she disagree with them, or maybe a bit of both? I've got their welcome complicity and welcome protest. And I guess I love it when children actually protest something about coming to meet with me and protest something about others' concerns, because I think that I can then be asking them and understanding more about why they're not so concerned, or what else they're concerned about, or things they know about themselves that has them perhaps not being so concerned. That's not to undermine other people's concern, but to honour and acknowledge the child's perspective on our meeting and on others' concerns as well. The third area is, of course, to find ways of acknowledging what it is that's problematic for Jenny. You know, what is it that worries her, and what is it that's concerning her? What is it that's important to her that she feels is somehow in jeopardy in her life at the moment? And I think this is so important to start where the child's at and follow their lead around what might be concerning her. This might be quite different to what others are concerned about, or there might be some overlap. But nonetheless, understanding this and exploring the context and being curious about Jenny's experience. We could make some guesses, I guess, from the case study about what she's concerned about, but whether it's about moving school or contact with her younger sister finishing up because of that move, who knows? This is why it's important to hold on to this position of curiosity, I think, and seek to understand that, and invite her collaboration and partnership in relation to this idea of a joint project, what it is that we can be working on together, that, you know, if things could be different, perhaps, in what way could things be different? You know, if our conversation could somehow make a small difference to things, what might they be? They're not questions necessarily I'd ask her, but I'm letting you know the intentions behind those questions as well. The fourth area that I'm really, again, on the lookout for is Jenny's responses to what is problematic for her. As I spoke about earlier, you know, she no matter what it is that's troubling her or concerning her, she'll be responding to this in some way. And again, I'm very interested in understanding the particulars of these responses and the foundation of them also in terms of, you know, what might be important to her or what she's hoping for or something that she really gives value to can be the foundation of these responses. I'm not saying she thought about this stuff before I've spoken with her, but through our conversation, this can be constructed. And brought into storylines and documented as well. Perhaps what she knows about how to respond to problems can come in handy with other children that I meet with, that she can actually contribute to other children in some way. And I think this can be a wonderful repositioning of kids as consultants rather than just as recipients of services as well. And again, a different sense of themselves, their identity. And finally, just briefly, I've just included these because I guess these practices reflect an ethic of attention to safety, but also being accountable to children's experiences as well, our practice being accountable to how they experience our work with them in terms of giving them choices and asking permission to ask questions, in terms of inviting their evaluation about our conversations and the helpfulness or not of them, and also talking about the talking. So asking them, is it okay? Or what would it be like to be talking about some different areas of life? So I'll finish there, but I'm very happy to sort of expand on these as we go through the discussion section, Dan.
Thanks so much, Chris. Really appreciated the way that you provided some really practical skills there about how we might, I suppose, bring Jenny's sense of protest and her own sense of know-how and skill to the fore within your engagement with her. So great. So now I'm going to hand over to Kate to give us a speech pathologist perspective.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. So as I kind of mentioned in the introduction, I think it is important for all practitioners to be thinking and being curious about a child's communication skills when they're working with someone who's experienced complex trauma. And, you know, sometimes I think it's important to note that difficulties with communication skills can be a really silent disability for children, and they can often appear to look really competent in their interactions initially with you and their peers. And sometimes it won't be till you really get into what you hope would be reflective discussion or, you know, some more complex discussion that you might start to see some signs that that young person's having difficulties in those interactions. And the evidence does tell us that it is the majority of children who've experienced complex trauma who go on to have speech, language and communication support needs. So it's just something to be really mindful about in our clinical practice. So, of course, as a speech pathologist, if I was working with Jenny, my starting point would be to be curious about her communication skills. And then I guess to echo a bit of what Jackie has said, there's a fair bit of work I might think about doing even prior to meeting with Jenny. So I really want to think about collecting information from people who know her well, but across different environments and different activities, and to get a really good feel of what her behaviour can be like and the fluctuations in that behaviour across activities, because that can give me a lot of information about how different contexts and stressors impact Jenny's communication skills. I also want to do everything I can to reduce any fear or anxiety Jenny's experiencing at the thought of engaging with me as a new professional. So some of the strategies I utilise around that is to perhaps send children an introduction letter or video prior to meeting me so they can have a bit of familiarity around what I look like, some of the details, and I want to be really transparent in that introduction as to what I plan and hope to talk to them about in our first meeting. If there is time and space, I think planning the content for initial sessions and initial engagements is really important, because being aware of the information that you want and need to get through or hope to get through in that initial engagement will help you to rehearse ways to simplify that information, and perhaps use some visual supports and be prepared for what kind of visual supports you might use for those conversations. And I think an example of that is, you know, most of us need to talk about issues of confidentiality and sharing of information and privacy in those initial engagement phases. But that's often really quite complex language with new vocabulary for children. So having some preparation time to think how you could communicate that in a more simplified and supported way can be really helpful. Then if I start to envisage my initial engagements with Jenny, I really want to think about how I utilise visual communication tools to reinforce the transparency of my interactions with her. So I might use tools like written schedules or visual schedules to demonstrate in a really concrete way what I'm going to ask of her through the session, and, you know, to utilise those tools for collaboration as well. They might become a negotiation tool between Jenny and myself as to how she's feeling, what topics she's prepared to talk to me about, what she's not, what activities she'd prefer to do, in what order, etc. And then I really, I guess most importantly, in that initial engagement with Jenny, just to reiterate, I guess, and echo Chris and Jackie again, I really want to learn from Jenny what she perceives as her strengths and support needs. So in regards to that, I need her to understand why she's been referred to speech pathology, and I need her to understand what I do as a speech pathologist and what I can offer. So again, I might try and look at videos, activities, sketching and doodling, any kind of activity that can support that conversation and maximise her understanding at a time where she might be feeling a bit stressed and anxious. And then to support her expression of her strengths and support needs, I might utilise skills like, you know, writing out different tasks that involve communication skills and allowing Jenny to place those along a continuum to give her opinion and her thoughts on how difficult or easy those tasks feel for her. Moving into goal setting with Jenny, I really want to maximise my ability to collaborate with her. And so sometimes young people might actually find it hard to express what their goals are for the future. And I might scaffold that a bit in terms of, you know, building on their strengths and interests and what I've learned about them. And again, utilising post-it notes or pictures to allow Jenny a way to show me her opinions on whether those things are part of the future she envisages for herself. And I've had other experiences where young people have quite a good vision for what they would like to do into the future. And so I might use mind mapping or sketching or some kind of visual communication medium to demonstrate, as I explain, how different communication skills relate to that big picture goal that they have for themselves. I also think it can be really helpful and really supportive just to use a simple written or visual schedule or scaffold to kind of collaborate with Jenny or other young people around the details of any intervention plan we negotiate. And that can become a really concrete support then that the young person has to refer back to. And then if I move into envisaging that Jenny and I work together for a period of intervention, I want to stay really vigilant to the fact that a person's communication skills can fluctuate in response to change in their emotional state and changes in the stressors that they're experiencing at any given time. So with that in mind, I want to build some communication support strategies just into all of our interactions and maintain that through our intervention. And then I really want to focus on the fact that when young people are having difficulty engaging or are having difficulty expressing themselves, they may actually be better able to demonstrate their opinions and their thoughts and express their ideas through showing rather than telling. So often if a young person's having difficulty engaging, I might design tasks, and there's an example there in on the table with lots of different photos all over it, where that young person was able to actually just use pictures to start to show me some preferences and show me some of her ideas and opinions on different topics, which was challenging for her to do verbally because of how much anxiety she was feeling about meeting me for the first time. And certainly keeping a record of any of these types of activities that you do can really serve a dual purpose in that it provides a communication support for the young person. So this could just be a single word bullet point list that summarises some of the key things that you talked about in the session, or it might be a photo of the activity you did. But it can, pardon me, can also serve as a memory aid into the future if you need to come back and revisit previous activities and previous discussions. So I guess in passing back to you, Dan, I would just encourage people to be curious about children's communication skills and think about ways that they can visually support their predominantly spoken interactions with children in their work.
Thank you so much, Kate. Really appreciated some of those really practical tips around activities that we can do with children and young people to help them feel more comfortable and more engaged and I suppose more active within their engagements with us. So now it's time for our question and answer segment of this session, and we've got some great questions coming in. So remember, if you do have a question that you want to ask any of our three panellists or all of them, please use the blue icon. We've got about 1,495 of you tuned in at the moment, so should be able to kind of be able to generate some great discussion. And so the first question that I've got, which is from our guest, is really thinking about the timing for thinking about intent and purpose of sessions with children. And Chris, I know you talked a little bit about that through kind of acts of protest about why a child might be wanting or not wanting to come and see you. At what stage would you start to talk to that child about the reason that they've actually come to a therapy session with you?
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, and thanks for the question. You know, I reckon in the first time I meet with a child, in the first session, by the end of it, I feel as I'd like to have some understanding of the child's understanding of how come we're meeting together. And, you know, in my language, what they might be wanting or hoping for from us meeting together. I'd like to get to that in that first session, but that doesn't always happen, of course, and it certainly doesn't come first. As I've spoken about, I'd like to give children a chance to speak about other things about their life besides whatever it is that's problematic, you know, those other aspects of life, and ensure that I've got some really rich descriptions of these things, children's skills or things that they enjoy, as I've spoken about. And a sense of also getting on to, yeah, just beginning to talk about their understanding of how the conversations come about. Because then it feels as though there's more to the invitation that I might extend to them to come back again. actually, if I've spoken about some of those realms. So yeah, to be fairly early on in my work with them, I want to begin to hear something about that.
Yeah, so that from what you're saying, there's a real balance between, you know, wanting to build rapport, but at the same time, not waiting too long to have the child kind of maybe feeling like they don't know why they're in a session with you.
That's right. It's not as though talking about why we're meeting together is contrary to rapport either, actually. I think those conversations are very respectful and honouring of the child's knowledge about these circumstances and can contribute to rapport rather than being contrary or undermining of rapport.
Thanks so much, Chris. And what about for you, Jackie? I might continue on with Lee's question if that's okay. How do you strike this balance between, you know, building rapport, but also creating intent and purpose within the sessions you have? Generally, I understand, with a parent and a child.
Yeah, that's right. I tend to work with parents and children. And I guess having both people in the room does change what you do slightly. I often will start with the parent and kind of have some sense from them about why we're there and what they've already told the child about how come we're meeting. And that's an opportunity for me to kind of observe both how the parent communicates with the child, but also how the child receives those communications. And it's something that I also do pretty early in engagement. It's certainly something I would do before the end of the first session, but it's something that I would often do quite up front in the first session. I also want to have some sense of why I think we're there. Often in my work, why we're there is to make things better between the child and their parent, or to help them to have a more joyful connection. And so I might also want to introduce a little bit about why I think they might have come to me, or what it is that I think I can offer, to see whether we can find a meeting place in the middle where their hopes and goals and understandings of what I do and my understanding of what I do can meet. So I think, much like Chris, quite early on, that would be a big conversation for me.
And I might go to you, Kate. You know, you came from quite a little bit of a different perspective from the speech pathologist perspective, but is it still within that context really important that a child at some stage in that first session knows why they're coming to see you?
Absolutely, because I think my overwhelming, I guess, some experiences have been that often, and I would say this for the general population, most people don't understand the role of a speech pathologist in regards to language skills outside of speech sound skills. And then I think that's further magnified in regards to complex trauma. And, you know, we're only really building our evidence base around the impacts of complex trauma on language skills. So I'm really aware that sometimes children will be immensely confused to hear that they've been referred to a speech pathologist. And I don't think any kind of helpful service can start at a place of confusion. So I certainly echo exactly what Jackie and Chris have said, in that I do start in that first session, certainly explaining my role, and even doing some education as to why a speech pathologist is part of a trauma healing service, and then giving some more information about why the young person was referred. So then, just like Jackie, I can start to hear and draw out the young person's perspective on that referral.
Thanks so much, Kate. The next question I'm going to actually ask all three of the panelists is from Janet. Now, Janet is really keen to hear some evidence-based interview techniques regarding children who have been affected by complex trauma. And so what I picked up in all three of your presentations was this idea of giving Jenny, in this case, a place to stand, to think maybe differently about herself or how she has acted in her life. I might start, Jackie, with you on that, because you talked a little bit about kind of just starting to notice things about Jenny and her behaviour, both in her session with you, but also a little bit more broadly than that.
Okay. I'm slightly thrown by the idea of the evidence-based skills, because I'm actually not sure that I know what the actual evidence says. I much more rely on, I guess, what I've experienced over a long time. But I do know that the quality of the relationship that you build is really pivotal in a lot of therapies. And I think that all therapies show that empathy and developing an ability to share with the child what you think they may be experiencing and have them understand that as empathy or something that actually does connect with their experience is really pivotal as part of an engagement and communication strategy that has to underpin absolutely everything. And where I think that sort of noticing and naming idea fits into that is that if I can show somebody an evidence to them, this is what I've noticed about you today, this is what I've noticed about you in other sessions, this is what I remember of your story, and this is kind of how I'm putting that all together and understanding that, does that fit for you, is a really beautiful way of not only trying to demonstrate your empathy, but demonstrate how you got there, which gives the child that place to stand where they can absolutely either accept or refute what you've offered. So I think probably that would be where I would come from in answering that question.
Yeah, thanks, Jackie. Kate, I might go to you next. Like, given some of the communication work that you're doing with children and some of the activities, how do you kind of see this question in terms of being able to give children a place to stand, which is maybe slightly more positive than the past?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things probably come to mind. So I guess not specifically the evidence about what specific questions to ask, but the evidence about how we empower young people, and certainly any of the person-centered focused literature identifies, you know, the high levels of empowerment and satisfaction that young people score and rate themselves when they have the opportunity to have their ideas and perceptions both heard and also recorded. So, and I think, you know, I've talked to colleagues before about the fact that, you know, if children are having difficulties with their communication skills, how can we feel really authentic that that young person has had an opportunity to be heard and to have that autonomy of what their experiences have been like for them? So, you know, I think I certainly utilise a lot of the person-centred thinking tools in my work with young people as part of that information collection, and utilising communication support strategies so that we can feel really confident that, you know, we're not misinterpreting young people, that it's a genuine representation of their thoughts and feelings on topics.
Thanks so much, Kate. And Chris, you talked a little bit in your presentation around, you know, giving Jenny a place to stand. Would you like to say a bit more about that?
I guess, thanks, Dan. And, I agree with what Jackie and Kate have spoken about. I guess the question has me thinking about the idea of evidence base, and really think that's so important, isn't it? It reflects kind of this understanding of the importance of accountability. Actually, that's why we're interested in evidence base, is because we want our practice to be accountable to something. And I guess I might find myself certainly wanting my work to be accountable to what's already known about practice, but also accountable to children's experience as well. So I think of in terms of that question around evidence base, there are certain like methodologies that are about that give people another place to stand in relation to the trauma they've experienced. I'm thinking of like the Tree of Life methodology, which I guess a number of participants in the webinar might be familiar with, which is a methodology, a collective narrative practice methodology, which there's a lot of literature evidence around that, which is very much about giving children and families another place to stand, another place to be able to make claims about who they are and what's important to them, from which then to speak about the trauma or the suffering or the hardship that they've experienced, but to do so in kind of a collective rather than individualistic ways, which is obviously a great antidote to the isolation that people experience on account of problems.
Thanks so much, Chris. And while I've got you, Sharon has got a question that she'd like you to expand a little bit on this subject of storylines that you talked about throughout your presentation.
Yeah.
So what are they and how do you use them therapeutically?
Sure. So I guess when I think of storylines in relation to children's skills or know-how, what I'm referring to is that we might hear about one incident or event where a child has done something or used a particular, what I call a skill, to make a difference to their life, initiate something, take some action. You know, we can consider this just one event in the child's life where they've employed this skill, where they've utilised this skill. Storylines, though, refer to actually trying to link that instance, that event, that use of that skill with other instances in their life where they've also used this skill. So tracing kind of like the history of this in their life and creating a storyline around that. So children have a sense of it not just being a one-off thing by chance, but actually it exists in different contexts in their life through time. And by doing that, we can also implicate others in the development of this skill. You know, there might have been audiences to this skill, where we can be asking the child questions about or where they learnt these things from. You know, there's always social and relational histories to these skills and links to culture and community and family and land for these skills as well. So that's what I mean by bringing them into storylines, linking them over time so kids have a sense of them being usable in their life into the future as well.
Thanks so much, Chris, and thanks to these dozens and dozens of great questions that are coming through. Hoping to get through as many as possible, and there's now 1,548 of you watching, and many of you are giving us questions, which is fantastic. One from Jean, who asked of Kate. Kate, I'm really interested in how you explain confidentiality using activities or visual cues.
Yeah, so I guess my starting point when thinking about discussions around confidentiality would be to start with some written information that's very accessible for the intended audience. So that can be modified as much as needed to the point of, say, pictures to represent some very simplified information, right through to some of that information, I guess, written at what we would just call a plain English kind of level of text. And then for children who need support to understand that, and I think I would extend this as well to parents and carers, is that sometimes we might expand on that with an activity. So an activity that comes to mind for me is that after we explain that kind of so in my role, I will often be talking to children, their carers, about how our sessions are confidential except for. And I wanted them to understand those exceptions, which are predominantly around my mandatory reporting responsibilities and if I think there's risk of harm to other people. And so we can use, visuals to demonstrate relationships to people and actually move a photo of different people into, you know, would I talk to this person about what we talked about today? And the child can demonstrate their understanding and knowledge of the confidentiality principle by showing whether, yes, that's someone you might need to talk to, or no, that's not. Likewise, we might do a similar process around topics. So I might introduce some topic cards to a child and help them to understand how we could categorise those about whether that was something I would need to talk to other people about, or whether that's something that would just stay between us in our session. And I also think there is a great range of resources that have been developed specifically across the disability sector. So initially intended for people maybe with intellectual disability, but now have really broader applications that provide little YouTube videos or printed resources that can explain the concept in more simplified and visually supported, in a visually supported way.
Thank you so much, Kate. Really appreciate that answer. I'm now going to ask of Jackie, because I've got a couple of questions from Monica and Cindy and others about this business of working with quite young children. So, Jackie, in your experience, is it possible? Is it a possible thing to be working with quite young children and their parents? And what kind of different skills or techniques do you need to be able to practice with them?
Sure. That's a really good question. When I'm working with parents and really young children together, I think one of the main things is to have plenty of play materials in the room that will have some kind of symbolic sense for children. So baby dolls and bottles and dolls houses and things that they're used to playing with, but that maybe represent connection and disconnection in some way. So train sets with tracks that can come apart and those sorts of things. And then if I work a lot with storytelling, so if I'm hearing a story about something that may have been troubling the family or that the parents puzzled about or something that's happened to the child, then a lot of what I do is observing the child and their interaction with the play materials. And I think the key is then getting confident with working out how the play that they're doing links to the story, because often they're playing out what's being told and playing out their perspective, because children understand things before they can really express them verbally. So they'll often show, much like Kate's been saying, they'll often show somehow with like play materials what's going on for them. So that would be a really key skill, I think, in engaging parents with young, really young children. And that can work with children really early.
Thanks, Jackie. And another question for you. So we're getting a couple of questions. Given your experience in working both with the parent and the child in the room, how do you negotiate a session with a parent who might inadvertently be using language which might be blaming a child for their experience of trauma?
I have a sort of orientation, if you like, to those conversations that is helpful, which I learned from Heather Chambers, which is always to be thinking about the good intentions behind any communication in a relational setting. And I guess I use that a lot. So I think about what the good intention from the parent is in communicating with me something about that child, even if it is in a blaming way. And it's usually to bring me into the conversation and trying to enlist my help. And then I'm also going to think about things that I call mistakes of meaning and blame. And I'll be quite overt about that, that perhaps there's been muddles made about who's responsible for what and why. and be quite overt about exploring whether that may have occurred in this relationship. So they'd be a couple of starting places that I would use in those conversations.
Thank you, Jackie. Next question is from Greg, who's working with a First Nation child who has experienced complex trauma. And asked Chris, you know, can you tell us a little bit about your experience in working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and their families, and how you do this in a respectful way, I suppose, particularly where there might have been intergenerational colonisation or trauma?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Dan, and thanks for the question. Certainly some of the practices that I've already outlined stand us in good stead, no matter the families, the cultural backgrounds of the families we're working with. I think the things that I outlined really do, you know, express, or the intent is to understand the child's world, to privilege their language, to contribute to their sense of agency. And through that storyline that I was speaking about also, you know, there can be links drawn to the social and relational history of those things that are important to the child, or their skills or what they're good at. Links can be drawn to other connections, to family, to culture, to community. And so I guess I first want to say those things stand us in good stead, I think, in working with Aboriginal First Nations families as well. There's other things at play, isn't there, as the question indicates, you know, broader forces at play and long histories of oppression and marginalisation faced by Aboriginal families and communities as well. I guess something else I want to say because of that is the importance of partnerships, actually, for me, in working with Aboriginal children and families. Partnerships with Aboriginal practitioners, Aboriginal service providers, and the particular nature of that partnership changes obviously on the context and the role that they're doing and I'm doing, I guess. But to find ways where I can be that I can be accountable for my work with those families, but we have a sense of kind of working together. So I think partnerships and considering what that metaphor might mean for practice is really significant as well. But intergenerational trauma, disadvantage. As I said, there are broader forces at play, and so I think we need to find ways not to individualise the effects of these things in families' lives, in children's lives. And so certainly, you know, when meeting with, if I was meeting with a family, parents, before meeting with a child, that is my preference to understand their concerns, we want to create space to, as I'm understanding the context of their lives, to be creating space and asking questions that allow them to speak about these broader forces at play in their life. But those stories of intergenerational trauma aren't the only stories I'm wanting to get onto as well. I'm also wanting to hear other accounts of how they get through these things, other, you know, stories of survival, strong stories. That Aboriginal communities have been telling stories for a long time that kind of support connection to land and community. So I'll be wanting to get onto those as well. And finding ways to, with the family, like the Tree of Life methodology I mentioned, these more collective approaches to working with children and families. So, seems so much more to say. There's some things that come to mind anyway, Dan, in relation to
that question. Thanks, Chris. Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you very much. The next question is for you, Kate. It's from Rachel. And she asks, what can teachers do to support children with trauma, particularly where they might be having issues at school around a regulation, or they might be really avoidant of school?
So, look, you know, it's a big day, isn't it? The school day for children and teachers when, you know, young people are having trouble with engaging in that environment. The speech pathologist in me really, you know, wants to talk to the value in using visual support to, I guess, as a tool to support some of that trauma-informed education principles and more general trauma-informed practice principles. because I think sometimes when we talk about, and I've had a look at a lot of the different trauma informed education models through different organisations, and, you know, they all share those same principles of, you know, transparency and trust and choice and collaboration and some of those core principles. And I think when we visually represent information for young people, we actually are supporting the implementation of all those principles. Because if information is concrete for me, then I am more calm and less anxious because I know what's coming. And I'm more trusting of my interaction with you because you've shown me in a way I can understand of what's coming in my day. I think, you know, there is one of the main principles of speech pathology practice is an understanding that all behaviour can hold a communicative function. So when we look at functional behavioural analysis, you know, we can take that approach of going, well, what did that behaviour communicate for that young person? And then what is the skill that we need to support that young person in learning at an earlier level in that escalation? And often that is an emotional regulation skill that is also linked with the ability to label and speak about and utilise language around that. So I think there's so much and such a great partnership that can be had between health professionals and education for children who've experienced trauma. And just a bit of a shout out in terms of resources, there's some brilliant education, trauma-focused education podcasts I've been listening to lately that, you know, I really recommend people Google and get on board with. It's super helpful.
Thank you, Kate. One more question for you. So we talked a little bit tonight about children's regulation in their lives and, of course, in therapy. But what about practitioner self-regulation, where they might be feeling a level of anxiety about what the young person or child's coming to speak to them about? What sort of skills do practitioners need in keeping themselves grounded and keeping themselves open to the child within the sessions that they have with them?
Yeah. I think this is super important, and certainly for me, I can reflect on this has been a skill that I've actively had to work on as a practitioner working with children who've experienced complex trauma, because we really need to be mindful of how our own emotional state before we enter an interaction with a young person. And we need to do that for many reasons. You know, first of all, we know that a lot of children who've experienced complex trauma can be hypervigilant to the non-verbal information that they're perceiving in an environment. And we need to make sure that our own emotional state isn't influencing that. We want to be able to come to an interaction curious and inquisitive about whatever a child brings up in session. And that requires us to be emotionally regulated and in a comfortable space so that we're not too reactive in the moment to what gets identified and raised by the child. So often, you know, personally, I like to take just a pause and before I meet with a young person, do a little check-in with myself where I'm at. And if I need to take, you know, a few seconds for a bit of a grounding activity to get myself into that nice emotionally regulated space, that's going to have a really positive influence on my interaction with that young person.
Thank you so much, Kate. Look, unfortunately, because we've got lots of great questions still coming in from the 1,585 of you who are tuning in, but I think we're going to have to leave it there for the structured questions for tonight. Thank you so much to all of you for those great questions, and of course to our panelists who have answered them all in such a nuanced and diligent way. So thank you. So what I'm going to do now is hand over to each of our panelists just to kind of maybe provide one final observation or just to sum up. So I might start with you, Jackie, if that's okay.
Sure. It's really difficult to sum up such a rich discussion, but I guess the things that came to me as I was listening was just that really what we've been talking about is making sure that everybody, in, and most particularly the child, has a sense of self and identity and has a sense of having agency in their interactions with us, so that they can begin to develop a sense of agency in relationship and in relationship to their own story. I guess when people are hurt in relationship, then there are a lot of complications around relationship, and that's kind of what came through to me in everyone's discussion is about context and relationship.
And thank you so much. Sorry, go on.
No, that's it.
Thank you, Jackie. That was fantastic. Chris, for final comments and observations.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And like Jackie, it's hard to kind of sum up, I find. But, you know, just even having another look at this case study and, you know, when I said before, there aren't many necessarily entry points into other aspects of Jenny's life beyond the problem. But I'm thinking, you know, what we do know about her, there's so much in excess of what's on the page here, isn't there, about Jenny's life. How can we be curious about that and provide openings to get onto other aspects of her life that are perhaps reflect things that are important to her or that she hopes for her life or that she really gives value to, whether it's her relationship with the youngest child in her current placement or her sister at school or even the lashing out and running away. There's energy and agency there. You know, she's protesting something there and how significant it might be to, and how just it might be to give a space to be inviting her to speak about those things in ways that are very honouring and acknowledging. And I guess that's one of the hopes that I bring to all my work with kids in relation to their experiences of trauma.
Thank you so much, Chris, and for your answers tonight. And Kate, I'd like to hand over to you now for final comments.
I think the thing that has really struck me tonight is that all of the panellists' perspectives share a lot of commonalities, and that although, you know, at times we're using slightly different language, we are all still talking about those same principles and prioritising those same principles for young people. And it's just really, I suppose highlighted to me the value of accessing a multidisciplinary team when that's available or, you know, utilising our resources across professions and across a service system to help meet the needs of young people like Jenny.
Thank you so much, Kate. And again, thank you to all of our panellists tonight. I'm sure you'll agree that their presentations and answers have been really fantastic. So really appreciate that. Okay, so that brings us almost to the end of tonight's webinar. So just in terms of resources and further reading, so we've got some other supporting resources associated with this webinar, which can be found by clicking on the light blue supporting resources icon, and really kind of encourage you to do that because there's some great, papers and e-learning resources which will hopefully support your practice with children and young people. For more information about Emerging Minds, please visit us on www.emergingminds.com.au. And again, we've got some upcoming webinars in 2021, which we really look forward to bringing to you in collaboration with MHPN. And they're, again, working with parents who have had their children removed, overcoming communication challenges to engage children, and a special webinar later in the financial year on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. So before you go tonight, please ensure that you do complete the feedback survey before you log out. So we really count on hearing what you think about our webinar so that we can make sure that we strive to improve what we do and continue to get better. So again, that's the yellow icon on the top of your screen. In terms of statements of attendance for this webinar, they'll be issued to you within about 4 to 6 weeks. And each participant will be sent a link to the recording of this webinar and associated online resources. Again, that will be within 4 to 6 weeks. So this webinar was co-produced by MHPN and Emerging Minds for the Emerging Minds National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health National Project. The National Project is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health under the National Support for Child and Youth Mental Health Program. And would you like to continue this discussion with your local practitioners? Because often these webinars are only the start of much richer conversations. Or perhaps you might like to start discussing issues of local relevance. MHPN project officers are available to help you establish and or join interdisciplinary mental health networks across metropolitan, regional, rural and remote Australia. MHPN have 373 networks across the country. You can visit them online or their online map to find out which networks are closest to you, or at mhpn.org.au, or contact Jackie O'Loughlin at networks@mhpn.org.au. So thank you again to our panellists and to all the people that have tuned in tonight, and again to the fantastic questions. It's been a really rich discussion. For those of you who follow the MHPN webinars, please tune in on the 10th of December for a webinar on collaborative approaches to working with children affected by grief. So that's it for tonight. Before I close, I'd just like to acknowledge the consumers and carers who've lived with mental illness in the past and those who continue to live with mental illness in the present. Thank you to everyone for participation this evening. Thank you and good night.